8, to the Gospel of Matthew, Matthew chapter 16. For those of you who were here last week, you recall we began a Lenten series as we move toward Easter, and we're continuing this journey with Jesus toward Jerusalem, and we're going to continue on in the same passage that we started last week, Matthew chapter 16. So turn with me there if you will. We'll look together at verses 20 and 21, and then we'll jump over to chapter 20 and take a peek at some verses there as well. Now, before we read these verses, let me just give you a little backdrop. Last week, I kind of left you dangling, for those of you who are here, if you remember that. We had looked at this passage where Jesus had said to his disciples, "Who do people say that I am?" And they said, "Well, some say you're Elijah, some say you're Jeremiah, some say you're one of the prophets." And Jesus said, "But who do you say that I am?" And God had given Peter that revelation, and he said, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." And as we explored that last week, we realized who this was. We realized that Jesus, the Son of the living God, is actually the one true living God come in flesh. And it is upon that truth, Jesus said, that he was going to build his church. And as he built his church, the gathering of his people throughout the ages, he said that not even the gates of hell would prevail. Not even the gates of hell would stop the onward march of what God was doing in building his church. And then he went as far as to say that this truth was going to be the primary key that he was going to give us to unlock those gates of hell and to lock them when necessary and to loose and bind in the spiritual realm. And he provided you and me as God's people with incredible ammunition, spiritual ammunition, to do his work in this world. I mean, if you weren't here last week, and please get the tape from the library. This is one of the most foundational passages there is in Scripture to understand God's work in the world through the church. But I find it fascinating that after explaining all of that, which gets you really excited about the church and about God's eternal plan and about him using us in this dynamic spiritual way, he then gets to the verse that we come to tonight. Look at it. Matthew 16, verse 20. "Then he warned his disciples not to tell anyone that he was the Christ." From that time on, Jesus began to explain to his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things at the hands of the elders, chief priests, and teachers of the law, and that he must be killed and on the third day be raised to life. And Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. "Never, Lord," he said, "this shall never happen to you." Now go over to chapter 20 and look at verse 17. "Now as Jesus was going up to Jerusalem, he took the 12 disciples aside and said to them, 'We are going up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be betrayed to the chief priests and the teachers of the law. They will condemn him to death and will turn him over to the Gentiles and be mocked and flogged and crucified. On the third day, he will be raised to life.'" If you're like me, you have to ask the question, why, after Jesus has just declared this incredible principle, this incredible truth upon which he said he was going to build his church, that the one true living God became flesh, that the God who saves came in flesh in order to do the saving, that this truth was going to be the foundation for God's work in the world, it was going to be the primary key which would cause you and me to be victorious in the spiritual realm, after declaring that, he then says, "Now don't tell anybody. Don't tell anybody." Doesn't that seem kind of strange? I mean, if you're a Christian, you probably heard throughout the ages or throughout your Christian experience that we're supposed to tell people about Jesus. We're supposed to witness. We're supposed to declare that he is the Messiah. Why in the world would he tell us here not to tell? Well, let me give you an illustration which I think will clarify it. A little over a year ago, somebody saw me hugging and kissing a woman that was not my wife. And I said to them, "Don't tell anybody." Now, I know I've got your attention. The reason I said I didn't want them to tell was because they didn't understand the full picture. You see, that woman that I was hugging and kissing, and I was. They were true. It was right that I was. But that woman was my mother. Isn't it amazing how that little piece of information changes the picture? It does, doesn't it? You see, if that person who saw me would have simply gone out and said, Pastor Dave was hugging and kissing another woman that wasn't his wife, would they have been true? Good evening, you can talk. Would they have been true? Yes, they would have been true. But what would that information have done? It would have been devastating for me. It would have been devastating for the reputation of the church. It would have been devastating in its ramifications. Because although it was true, it was not complete. And therein lies the problem. That is kind of the condition the disciples were in when Jesus told them not to tell. You see, Peter had just professed by the inspiration of the Holy Spirit that this person, this Jesus, was in fact the Messiah, the Son of the living God. But the disciples didn't really understand at that point what that meant. You see, in that day, when people thought of Messiah, they anticipated somebody very different than who Jesus was. They anticipated a conquering king, someone who would deliver them from Roman oppression, someone who would establish an earthly kingdom, someone who would bring them health and wealth and happiness. In other words, the people of that day had fashioned a Messiah in their thinking according to their desires. And then they projected what they had fashioned Messiah to be into reality and believed that when Messiah came, that's what he would be like. Now, before you get too tough on the people of that day and say, boy, they were kind of silly, let me suggest to you that we do exactly the same thing today. I read with interest about a week ago in the newspaper, an American newspaper, that at a recent Christian ecumenical conference on women, the participants were praying to Sophia, Creator God. And their prayer at the beginning went something like this: Our Maker, Sophia, we are women in your image. Now, although they were blasted by Christian leaders from many denominations, liberal churches, evangelicals, mainline, whatever, many people were hard on them for attempting to redefine God's nature. The Reverend Kathy Austin Molly of St. Paul, Minnesota, co-chairman of the steering committee, said in defense, we wanted women speakers who were doing cutting-edge theology. Cutting-edge theology? My foot. That's more than cutting-edge, friends. That's way out on a limb. Now, I can appreciate why women who feel abused, who feel like they have no place in the church, who feel like they've been put down, I can appreciate why women struggle with trying to figure out who they are in the Lord and how God, who is supposed to be the Father, who's supposed to be male, has something to do with them. I can appreciate the struggle. But to jump from there to the place of trying to redefine the nature and the character and the person of God based on what you want Him to be, that's a mighty big step. A mighty big step. Now, by the way, did you know that God is not male? Did you know that? God is not a male. And neither is He a female. He is asexual. There is male pronouns and female pronouns. There are male attributes and female attributes in the nature of God. But what these people have been trying to do is trying to redefine His nature. Now, it's not just those people, it's many people throughout the ages, and like I say, even we today have attempted to do that in many ways. We try and redefine or try and shape God, try and shape the Messiah according to our desires. I find it interesting that at the same conference, it's not accidental that these people also were downgrading the doctrine that God and humanity are reconciled through Christ's sacrifice on the cross. Whenever you tamper the nature of God, you have the ramifications of also misunderstanding how He works with His people. Now, even the disciples had this problem back then. As I said, they had fashioned a Messiah according to their desires, so that when Jesus immediately began to tell them that that's not what He was about, He immediately began to tell them the whole story, to explain what He meant, to define His terms. And when He did, Peter's response was, no way, Lord, there's no way I'm going to let them do that to you. His response proves my point, that he didn't understand what Jesus meant when he said Messiah. And so Jesus told them once in chapter 16. He told them twice in chapter 20. And I'm sure that he told them many times on the way to Jerusalem what he meant and what his messiahship was about and what he was going to do. He told them to sink it into their thick skulls that their anticipation of what Messiah was very different than what he was planning to do. I want you to notice what he said, what he predicted about himself as he was going to Jerusalem. If you compare the Matthew 16 and the Matthew 20 passages with which we read, you will notice that he predicted 8 things that were going to mark his messiahship. 8 things that were in store, that were in line for what he was about to do and what were going to be done to him. The 8 things he said were this. Number 1, he must go to Jerusalem. Number 2, he would be betrayed to the religious leaders. Number 3, he would suffer many things at the hands of the religious leaders. Number 4, the religious leaders would condemn him to death. Number 5, the religious leaders would turn him over to the Gentiles. Number 6, he would be mocked and flogged. Number 7, he would be killed, crucified. Number 8, he would be raised to life on the 3rd day. Now, how did Jesus do in his predictions? 50%? 60%? I must admit, I get a kick every year, at least it's this way in North America. All the psychics have their heyday, and they make predictions about what's going to happen in the next year. Do you ever read those things? This is going to happen, this is going to happen, everything from what's going to happen to the president to who's going to have a baby to the unbelievable stuff. Which plane's going to crash on which day? And that's kind of interesting at the beginning of the year as you anticipate what's coming, but at the end of the year, it's important to hold them accountable. And most of them are way out to lunch. I mean, they're right off the walls in terms of their stupidity sometimes. How did Jesus do in his predictions? He predicted 8 things here. How did he fare? Well, if you look at the passage, just continue to read in Matthew, you realize, let's quickly take a look. He said he must go to Jerusalem. Well, you know from the narrative, he did get to Jerusalem. But why did he have to get to Jerusalem? Why did he must get to Jerusalem? That's poor English, but I'm trying to combine the sentences there. Well, if you know the scripture, you know that Jerusalem is the city of peace, the place where God and man are brought back into fellowship. It's also the place of sacrifice. You remember back in Genesis 22 when God told Abraham to take his son, Isaac, the son of promise, up onto the mountain, up to Mount Moriah, where he was supposed to sacrifice him. Abraham, in obedience, took him to the top of that mountain, bound him. Before he was about to slay him, God stopped him, provided a ram caught in the thicket, and gave it to him for sacrifice. That's where God revealed himself as Jehovah Jireh, the Lord who would provide. And he said, it's on this mountain that the Lord's provision would be seen. On which mountain? On Mount Moriah. Well, you zip ahead thousands of years and you realize that Calvary, the very mountain peak on which Jesus was crucified, is one of the peaks of Mount Moriah. The very same mountain. On that mountain, the Lord's provision will be seen. Jesus must go to Jerusalem. Secondly, he would be betrayed to the religious leaders. Matthew 26:14 tells us that Judas went to the chief priests and betrayed him. Fulfillment. Thirdly, he would suffer many things at the hands of the religious leaders. Did he suffer? Matthew 26:67 and 68 says that they spat on him, they struck him, they punched him, they slapped him, they mocked him, saying, "Who hit you?" He suffered a lot at their hands. Fourthly, the religious leaders would condemn him to death. Did they? Well, if you go to Matthew 26... and look at verse 63. The high priest said to him, "I charge you under oath by the living God. Tell us if you are the Christ, the Son of God." "Yes, it is as you say," Jesus replied. "But I say to all of you, in the future you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One and coming on the clouds of heaven." Then the high priest tore his clothes and he said, "He has spoken blasphemy. Why do we need any more witnesses? Look, now you have heard the blasphemy. What do you think?" "He is worthy of death," they answered. And then they spit in his face and struck him with their fists. Others slapped him and said, "Prophesy to us, Christ, who hit you?" Fulfilled prophecy. Fifth, the religious leaders would turn him over to the Gentiles. If you go to Matthew 27:1-2, you read, "Early in the morning, all the chief priests and the elders of the people came to the decision to put Jesus to death. They bound him, led him away, and handed him over to Pilate, the governor, a Gentile." Sixth, he would be mocked and flogged. Move down to verse 27. It says there, "Then the governor's soldiers took Jesus to the praetorium and gathered the whole company of soldiers around him. They stripped him and put on a scarlet robe on him. and then wove a crown of thorns and sat it on his head. They put a staff in his right hand and knelt in front of him and mocked him. "Hail, King of the Jews," they said. They spit on him and took the staff and struck him on the head again and again. After they had mocked him, they took off the robe and put on his own clothes on him, and then they led him away to crucify him. Seventh prediction is that he would be killed, he would be crucified. In 27:33 it says they came to a place called Golgotha, which means the place of the skull, and there they crucify him. And then the eighth prediction is that he would be raised to life on the third day. Pretty strange prediction. Uncustomary, I might add. Chapter 28 says, after the Sabbath at dawn on the first day of the week, Mary Magdalene and the other Mary went to look at the tomb. There was a violent earthquake, for an angel of the Lord came down from heaven and, going to the tomb, rolled back the stone and sat on it. His appearance was like lightning, and his clothes were white as snow. The guards were so afraid of him that they shook and became like dead men. The angel said to the women, "Do not be afraid, for I know that you are looking for Jesus who was crucified. He is not here. He has risen, just as he said. Come and see the place where he lay, then go quickly and tell his disciples. He is risen from the dead, and he is going ahead of you into Galilee. There you will see him. Now I have told you." How did Jesus do on his predictions? 100%. 100% accuracy. Now, I want you to imagine what that series of predictions did to the disciples. We have hindsight, and we say, "Wow, wasn't that marvelous?" But at that point, they didn't have the fulfillment. They only had the predictions. Those predictions completely turned upside down the world of the disciples, their comprehension and understanding of Messiah. They had defined God and His salvation on their terms. They had crafted their own strategy for Messiah. Surely they knew better than Jesus as to how He was to bring about the kingdom. And then Jesus has the audacity to turn it all around on them. I'm sure they were absolutely stunned with His announcement, with His predictions. Let me give you an illustration of this. I remember as a teenager, a friend of mine introduced me to one of his friends who became a good friend of mine. And when I first met him, I noticed this guy was, he seemed like he was way older than us. He was much better built. I was 14 years old at the time, and this kid looked much, much older. He had a full beard at 14. I still can't grow one. And he was more husky. His voice had already changed. And I just thought, "Whoa, what are we hanging around such an old kid for?" I probed and discovered this kid was our age. He was only 14. And as I got to know him a bit better, I began to ask him, "Well, when did you start growing a beard?" And I discovered it was about 3 years before that. And as I probed with other questions, he opened up and shared with me that he had a rare disease. His body was aging basically at twice the speed, and he said the doctors predicted that he would be dead by the time he was 30. And so he said to me, "Dave," he said, "I'm going to be dead by the time I'm 30 or before." Initially, I was shocked. It was like somebody punched me in the stomach. And after, my curiosity got the best of me, and I began to pummel him with questions. "You mean you're going to be dead by 30? Well, what about this? What about that? And what does it mean for this?" And I just began to explore with all kinds of questions. I have a hunch that probably the disciples responded the same way. Jesus had just said, "I'm going to Jerusalem to die." And I don't know if they just said, "Oh, okay, bye." After an initial shock, the initial thud, they probably began to pummel him with questions and probe, "What does this mean? What about this? What about that?" I kind of have that hunch because as you look at the New Testament, after it all did come to pass, after all these prophecies were fulfilled, they could speak and they could write with clarity because they knew then that none of this was an accident, but it was God's ordained plan of salvation from eternity past. Which brings me to the second part of this message. I want you to not only notice what Jesus predicted, the specifics of it, but I want you to consider with me tonight the fact that Jesus predicted. You see, my friend predicted that he would be dead by the time he was 30. He was right. Was my friend a prophet? Was he a prophet? I predict tonight that by 10 o'clock I am going to be in my apartment. If that comes to fulfillment, does that make me a prophet? No, why? It's a prediction. Those are called self-fulfilling prophecies. Okay, I predict it, and then I can fulfill it. But to predict something over which you have no power, over which you have no authority, over which you can do nothing about, and for that to come to pass, that's in a different league. If you look at what's happening to Jesus and the predictions he's making, basically, some of them could be called self-fulfilling. I'm going to Jerusalem. Okay, so he went. But look at the other stuff surrounding that. They're not self-fulfilling prophecies. They're things that are done to him. I may be an okay planner in planning my evening and getting home, but I'm not a prophet. To predict the events and details surrounding your death, and then to proclaim with a straight face that after three days, you're going to break the bonds of death and rise back to life? Friends, these are not the words of your average sane person. These sound like the words of some lunatic. Either that, or they are the words of somebody who actually knew the future from the past and had the power to do something about it. See, many people may wonder what makes Jesus so special. Have you ever wondered that? Have you ever had anybody else ask you that? If you're an honest Christian grappling with issues of your faith, you have to ask that question. Why are you a Christian and not a Buddhist? Why do you believe in Jesus and not in somebody else, in Krishna? Why are you a Christian? Why do you believe in Jesus? What makes him so special? Well, if I had time tonight, we could talk about a whole bunch of different things. We could talk about his purity. There's no other human being on the face of the earth who has ever lived 100% pure, without sin, except Jesus. But we won't talk about that fact tonight. We could talk about his power. The fact that he went around and did incredible miracles. I mean, do you hear of many people raising the dead? Do you hear of many people walking on water, calming the storm, feeding thousands with a few loaves and fishes? Do you see many people healing the eyes of the blind and cleansing the lepers? No, his power set him apart. He was unique. But we won't talk about that tonight. We could talk about his person, the uniqueness of his nature, which is different than any other human being. That set him apart, but we won't talk about that. We could talk about his passion, his love for humanity that drove him, that caused him to care for all who came to him. But we won't talk about that uniqueness. We could talk about his purpose. Every other human being seeks their own good. Jesus said, I didn't come to be served. I came to serve and to give my life a ransom for many. We could go on and talk about different things that make Jesus unique. But the thing I want you to hear and think about tonight is the role of prophecy in the life of Jesus. This issue of prophecy sets Jesus Christ totally apart. This issue of prophecy sets the Holy Scriptures totally apart. Do you realize, friends, that the Bible is the only religious book in the world that is chock full of prophecy? It's the only book that has this kind of prophecy that spans the centuries, indeed the millenniums. No other book does. None of them. And that's why the Bible is so unique. And that's why Jesus is so unique, because he is the only one on whom so much prophecy has been focused. It sets him in a league all of his own. Jesus' ability to prophesy his own suffering, his own death, his own resurrection, and his own exaltation, combined with hundreds of Old Testament prophecies pointing to his life, makes him absolutely unique. Untouchable, there is no one who compares. There is no one else in all of human history who can even be put near him in comparison. Let me give you a mathematical illustration to prove my point here tonight. Now, if you were here around Christmas time, you may have heard me share this, but for those of you who weren't, it'll be new information. A mathematician in the United States was very interested in trying to find out what the odds were of some of these prophecies coming to fulfillment. And so he selected 7 of the prophecies from the Old Testament dealing with the birth of Jesus Christ, like the town in which he would be born, he'd be born of a virgin, the family line, the tribe through which he would be born. He chose 7 of those most common, most famous predictions or prophecies dealing with the life of Christ. He fed it into a mathematical computer and said, what were the odds of these 7 prophecies coming to fulfillment in one person at a point in time in history? This computer analyzed it and gave back the information and said that the odds of that happening were 1 in 10 to the 23rd power. Now, if you're not a mathematician, let me tell you what that means. It means the odds are 1 in 10 and with 23 zeros behind the 10. If that still is over your head, let me explain it a bit further. That means, how big is that number? Well, if you have any idea for how large Texas is a pretty big place, something like the country of Egypt. What's the difference anyway? Is Egypt larger or smaller than Texas? Somebody know? It's smaller? Egypt is smaller? Egypt is larger? Help me, somebody. It's larger? Okay, well, they're similar. Anyway, if you look on a map, you'll probably see that they're both large. But Texas is the largest state in the United States. And if you can imagine taking the whole state of Texas and then get silver dollars, about this big, silver dollars, and if you cover the entire state of Texas 1 foot thick with those silver dollars, that's how much 10 to the 23rd power is. Okay, that's how many we're talking about. Now take one silver dollar, paint it blue, mix it up in all those silver dollars, blindfold somebody, and tell them to go pick it out. Do you think he'd get it? That's the odds, friends, of these seven prophecies coming to fulfillment in one person at one point in time. But you know what? In the Old Testament, there's more than seven. Jesus gave eight prophecies right in this passage dealing with his upcoming suffering and death. In the Old Testament, there are over 200 prophecies relating to the life and death and burial and resurrection and exaltation and second coming of Christ. They defy the odds. There's no way you can put that into a computer and come up with any number that's conceivable. And it makes me ask, who is this one who defies all the human odds? Who is this one who tells the future as if it were the past? Who is this Messiah who came to suffer and die and rise again from the dead? Who came to show himself as Messiah in a way that was so different than what we expected? Who is this Son of the living God? Who is he? He's Jesus. Yeshua, Jehoshua, Jehovah Yasha, the one and only God who saves. That's who he is. The one true living God who saves, who actually came into flesh into our world in order to do the saving. That's who he is. Now, if you're one of those people, friends, who has a tendency to only tell part of the story, if you only tell part of the secret of who Jesus is, then there's a warning for you in the scripture tonight. If you only describe Jesus as the Messiah as you would like him to be, if you only describe Jesus as you painted him to be in your mind, in your desires, if you only describe Jesus as one of the ways to God, if you only talk about Jesus as one of three gods or one of many gods, if you only talk about Jesus as a prophet or a great teacher or a good man or a great model to follow, if that's how you describe Jesus, friends, then zip your lip. Don't do it. Because you, like the woman who saw me kissing my mother, will do more damage than good. Because although your information may be true in part, if it is not given in the context of the whole, it confuses people in terms of who Jesus really is. But let me hasten to say that if you are willing to declare the simple truth, yet the profound reality of who he is, that the one true living God who saves became flesh in order to do the saving, and that this one in flesh was Jesus, the Messiah, then friends, tell the secret. Let it out of the bag. Proclaim it boldly, joyfully, continuously. because that is the one secret our world is desperately longing to hear and desperately needs to know. It's the one secret that will change their lives for time and for eternity. Please join me in prayer.